legislative update on marijuana. And to do that, I kind of have to give you a little bit of background as to where, how we got here. So everybody understands, does it look like this is working or is it working? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so historical background. Then we'll go through a little bit of overview on marijuana, a little bit about the debate on marijuana and the national trend. Medical versus recreational, some of the pros and cons, and then the updates in California. So all of that background will give us some context to where we are in California and some what are the implications. So I'm going to use the term marijuana, although marijuana and cannabis have been used interchangeably. I use marijuana because it's the term that's used in the law, in the Marijuana Tax Act, in the Controlled Substance Act, and also in the California Controlled Substance Act, which we adopted in 1994. So a little bit of historical background. The Controlled Substance Act of 1970 first classified marijuana as a Schedule I. And I'm going to explain, for those of you who don't understand, what that means. So Schedule I is the highest regulated schedule in the Controlled Substance Act. It has the highest restrictions because these drugs in that category have the highest risk of abuse. If they are labeled as having no accepted medical use and are thereby deemed illegal. There were many prior attempts before 1970 in U.S. history to do this, to outlaw addictive drugs because of the consumer protection aspect and public health aspect. And by 1970, there were over 200 drug laws. Many of them criminalized drug use and abuse, but they were very difficult to keep track of. In fact, because there were so many laws and difficult to keep track of, they were ineffective in actually managing the country's drug problem. So in 1970, President Nixon, Richard Nixon, put all of these drugs into one statute, and we have the Controlled Substance Act. He did this to categorize the potential addictive behavior of the drugs, the nature and the dangerousness. And what happened? Marijuana was placed in that C1 category, the Schedule I category, ostensibly at that time as a placeholder. Because for hundreds and thousands of years, it had been used medically for many purposes before 1970. So I say as a placeholder because the idea at the time was it was going to be lumped into this category, Schedule I, with other heroin, LSD, hallucinogens, etc., that don't have that same medical use premise. And the president would commission a long-term research study to determine what schedule to put it in. So it was a placeholder in Schedule I. And we know that it hasn't changed, so that's what happened in the interim. President Nixon did commission a report from scientists called the Schaefer Commission Report. He asked scientists to study marijuana. And the results of that report, the scientists, like us, didn't feel that marijuana should be in Schedule I. President Nixon, though, was determined that marijuana would stay as a Schedule I. He wanted to rally support for his, quote, war on drugs, unquote, his campaign of war on drugs. And so what happened to the Schaefer Commission report is that the findings were largely ignored, kind of swept under the rug. We call in legal terms, he quashed the report. He didn't allow it to be released. Shortly after, there was a petition to remove it from Schedule I, and there would have been other petitions since then. But we have the war on drugs. If you could see the image now, I have a poster of President Nixon's war on drugs. It's an image of him saying that public enemy number one was drug abuse in the United States at that time. And he aimed to return law and order, basically, to the U.S. by demonizing the behaviors of the hippie culture, and that included marijuana use. In the 47 years since then, a lot of our society, scientists too, have questioned the war. Social scientists, other correctional rehabilitation scientists, have questioned the war because it's basically the mindset there is that drug abuse is a victimless crime. And so why are we incarcerating people? That is their claim. And then others say, well, some wars aren't meant to be won. Were the social costs of this war on drugs too high? The cost in terms of dollars to prosecute, it cost in terms of incarceration, it cost in terms of social issues that happened to affect families and people that were in jail for, what some believe were victimless crimes. So a little bit of background on the law itself. In 1970, the law was passed by Congress. So the question I'm going to ask you, but you probably don't know the answer fully. If Congress passes a law like the Controlled Substance Act, who has the authority to modify it? The obvious answer is Congress. So yes, Congress passed the act, so they would have the authority to repeal or modify it. But we all know how long that takes. The act itself, though, has another provision that, short of a congressional amendment, the authority to decide whether or not marijuana or any other drug is changed or where it's classified in the act actually is vested in the U.S. Attorney General. So we look to that individual who has the authority to do that, but we know that that authority is an attorney, not normally a health practitioner or trained in health. And the law in the Controlled Substance Act says that the Attorney General must consult the Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services in order to make a change, before they make a change, to get a consensus on the science before they make a change. That's a dual decision. So in order to make a change for marijuana from C1 to C2, that would have to happen either a congressional amendment, relaxing the schedule that it's in, or the Attorney General would have to make that recommendation based on science provided to him by the Department of Health and Human Services. So a little overview on marijuana. We know it has a number of effects, and it's not easy to categorize in one simple drug class because it has, and it's very unique in that regard, it has properties and effects as a stimulant, as a sedative, as a tranquilizer, and as a hallucinogen, so it can't be pigeonholed in one pharmacological category. As far as its federal status, because it's Schedule 1 again, it has been deemed to have no legitimate medical use. I'm going to kind of clarify where the law sees this medical use in a moment. It is deemed unsafe for use, even under medical supervision, and it's also deemed as a fact that it's in Schedule 1 to have a high potential for abuse. So the term no legitimate medical use, it creates a lot of confusion because a lot of us in this room know we've read studies, we've read the news, if it's been used medically, even before the before 1970, it's been used medically since then. Whether or not those studies are substantiated, but we know it's been used medically. So the term creates confusion. Is there no legitimate medical use? Well, in fact, we know there's a variety of medical uses. It's been used medicinally for thousands of years. That's well known. But the point of clarification I'd like to make as an attorney is that the term in the law that says no legitimate medical use is really a legal term of art. It's not intended to say there's no medical use. There's a distinction here that has to be highlighted. The fact that it's in the Controlled Substance Act and it says no legitimate medical use really means this. It's just illegal for any purpose, including medical purposes, because the Controlled Substance Act has banned it. It doesn't opine whether the use that we're using for has been effective. We know there has been some effective use in pain and nausea for cancer patients, for glaucoma, and yada yada. There's other medical uses. So there's a nuance to the fact that it's in the law this way, and you shouldn't be confused by it. It just means that it's illegal for any purpose. So marijuana's medical use basically stopped effectively when it was classified as a Schedule 1 because it was deemed of having no medical value and the high potential for abuse. And as I said, before 1970, there were numerous medical conditions it was used for, similar to the uses now. Those were used before 1970. legalization of marijuana, the medical debate on marijuana. It's been a great debate, a lot of issues, and a lot of pros and cons. You have to look at both sides. There's room for debate, both for medical and for recreational. The pros for legalization of marijuana is to ensure availability for medical use when it's needed. The identified medical uses include anxiety, chronic pain, etc., post-traumatic stress, seizures, more recently seizures. And what's important to highlight here is that if it's moved from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2, it will be more available for research studies. And the benefits and risks can be evaluated more closely. We would get more information. As a C1 currently, most of the illicit supply is adulterated. It's not pure. There's no quality assurance on the street. And there's stigma associated even with medical use. One question I ask in this, on this side of the debate, the pros, who would be the gatekeeper if it is legalized? What happens with marijuana prescriptions? So just hold the thought for a moment. I'm going to go to the cons, those who want to keep Mary Jane and marijuana in the closet. Well, they say marijuana is a gateway drug and that evidence demonstrates it leads to other addictions and that legalizing marijuana would increase use and abuse of other drugs and because of its addictive properties. We also know it can lead to something like a DUI with alcohol, as in the case of alcohol. And we also know that it poses a public health problem. There are negative health consequences. There's certain adolescent learning disorders that have been shown to come about from early use in adolescence. And there's higher risks to those with mental illness. Again, in this category, consider who would be the gatekeeper. And we'll get to that in a few minutes. So addiction data shows that nearly 1 out of 11 people who has tried marijuana has become addicted to it. So that's about 9%. And one out of those who start using it in their teens, 1 in 6 becomes addicted. So that's 16.7%. For daily users, the addiction rate is 25 to 50%. So those are pretty significant numbers, and you can't just ignore those. Beyond addiction, there's other health effects that the National Institute on Drug Abuse has published: impaired short-term memory, slowed reaction time. It alters your judgment and decision-making ability. Alters mood and the risk of psychosis in vulnerable individuals, especially in mental illness, especially in those who have other psychotic disorders. A big one is early adolescent use and the learning issues. So there aren't many treatment options. There's some behavioral interventions. There's no medications that are used to treat it, the addiction for marijuana. More recently, there's some discoveries that talk about the cannabinoid system in the body and you holding promise there for developing some medications to treat marijuana addiction. But that's where that is right now. The national trend, we're going to look at medical versus recreational. And the foundational premise for the analysis is basically federal law. Marijuana is a Schedule I, and as a national federal law, it should apply uniformly to all states. That's a basic premise. We have the same law that governs all states, all 50 states, and it's banned in all 50 states. So why the dilemma? We have, in 2016, a record number of measures that moved to decriminalize marijuana and legalize its use in 2016. And I'm going to show you on the next slide a chart that all the measures that qualified for the ballot and that were passed. So we have from Arizona to Arkansas, California, Florida, Maine, Massachusetts, Montana, Nevada, North Dakota. These all had ballot measures. Some were listed as medical marijuana, some for recreational, and only one didn't pass. The one in red was Arizona. And so several of those classify them. 9 had measures on the ballot, 8 were approved, 1 was defeated. Tells you a lot about where the climate is nationally because of the states, everybody's different. And in California, the legalization proposal, because we are one of the largest or the largest state, affects the largest population and had the most expensive campaigns, both in support of it and in opposition to it. I will say, too, that over the last 30 years, there have been other propositions to pass legalization of recreational marijuana that have been defeated at the ballot box. So what is the significance of 2016? We'll see in a moment. The medical marijuana amendment and the Nevada amendment basically may have also, they note that may have also boosted voter turnout, making the issue a very important aspect of the presidential race of those two swing states. One interesting highlight is that of the whole country, 82 million residents live in states that have featured a 2016 ballot measure to loosen rules on marijuana. That's pretty significant out of about 40 million people in the country. The recent states that legalized medical marijuana were Florida, Arkansas, Montana, and North Dakota. Those together represent 75 million people. It's a lot. So here are the trends. Medical marijuana is now legal in 29 states out of 50, plus the District of Columbia. And recreational marijuana is legal in 11 states, plus the District of Columbia. So you can see the trend, and it looks like a wave. And in addition, some facts that are interesting. The majority of states now allow some sort of marijuana, whether it's legal for recreational or medical. But very important, in all of these, no state legislature has ever passed these. These have all been at the ballot. So people have passed this legislation, not the legislature. So that's interesting. And so it indicates some sort of a social change. Like, I grew up with marijuana was taboo. It just was there in the corner, keep it in the closet. And here this map also shows U.S. trends. So the green are the ones that legalized it for adult recreational and medical. So you kind of see the western states, the more populous states, more liberal states perhaps, legalized for medical use only are the blue ones. The green are where it's completely illegal still today, and the gray, sorry. And the red, those three states are what in 2017 are anticipated to legalize it this year. So New Mexico, Kentucky, Virginia, New Jersey, not too Delaware, I think, Rhode Island, and Virginia. So those, the ones that are marked in red are expected to legalize it this year. So another six states. So add that to the 29. We're kind of building up. And then I wanted to get to another phenomenon. There is actually three states where pharmacists dispense marijuana, where they're the gatekeepers. What's unique about this, and it's only in the recent years, Connecticut was the first one, Minnesota, and New York. As a pharmacist myself, I thought that was very curious because under the Controlled Substance Act, you're not allowed to touch marijuana. As a pharmacist, it's illegal. So what these states have done through their statutes, they have prohibited anyone other than a pharmacist and ordered that only pharmacists can dispense medical marijuana. So they don't have dispensaries that have unlicensed personnel, they have pharmacists. And it sort of makes sense because pharmacies have the infrastructure to handle controlled substances. So that's what made it interesting for me to do this research. Unique in New York is that it's a closed system. There's only 20 cultivators, 20 distributors, 20 dispensaries that have pharmacists working. It's a closed system. So it might be an interesting model for the future if this trend seems to follow through. And that's the reason I ask, like, who would be gatekeepers for marijuana, whether it's recreational or medical? Who would be the gatekeepers? Do you want them at the dispensary down the street where kids can just stop in and pick up some marijuana? There's a lot of pros and cons to having somebody who's licensed and educated in drug effects. And each of these states, I have them summarized. What's interesting about Connecticut is Connecticut on its own has changed the classification of marijuana to Schedule II. direct contradiction to federal law. So operating in a silo, it has done that. So each of these are operating in a silo with regards to dispensing marijuana in a pharmacy. If we had that, if I were to try to handle it in a pharmacy in California, I would lose my license because I don't have this protective statute. New York, just a year ago in January, started with this licensed pharmacist handling it, and even their school pharmacy there, Wegman, held a training day for pharmacists in the community to educate them on this new phenomenon. So interesting nuance. So what about the history of cannabis or marijuana in California? We basically were a pioneer. 1996, we passed the Compassionate Use Act, which provided a limited exemption from criminal prosecution. It did not legalize it across the state for every purpose. It just provided protection from criminal prosecution if you were allowed to use it for medical purposes. So you would have to have that recommended to you, not prescribed, because if even a doctor is a licensed individual, cannot prescribe marijuana. They can only recommend it. In 2004, that Compassionate Use Act was broadened a little bit by some legislative enactment that allowed for some collectives and cooperatives to grow marijuana, implemented some guidelines and limits about how much patients could possess or how much they could grow for their own use. And it also sanctioned the county health departments to implement a voluntary state marijuana ID system. So carrying an ID, a marijuana ID issued by the county Department of Public Health would allow these qualified patients to be protected from being arrested with it on their body. But it's a voluntary system. This is what the card looks like. There's some elements to it. It's state issued, state sealed. Each patient has an ID number. Now remember, it's voluntary, so not everyone carries one. Has a date of expiration. There's a place for dispensaries to verify the user is a qualified user by checking the website. And then it's issued by the County Department of Health. This one happens to be, it says Golden Grove County. It's just a mock one. But basically, this is what the official ID looks like with a picture of the cardholder. And how does that help them? It allows the bona fide carrier some protection against being arrested for carrying it. So if they have, on the recommendation of a physician, voluntarily registered for this card, they can be protected from that and also from prosecution. Out-of-state travelers doesn't cover them unless they are bona fide users. They have to have a recommendation from a California licensed provider. So if you're traveling, you have to be very careful. Registration is voluntary. So it really just is very narrow, limited exception or exemption as a potential defense against criminal prosecution. The other people that are authorized under this exemption are the caregivers and the cultivators of a bona fide user. The online verification site, and they're encouraged, dispensaries and law enforcement can use this to verify the person who's in front of them, whether they're registered as a bona fide user, and also whether the card is still valid. So recent legislative changes, these came through the legislature in California. In 2015, this created a lot of confusion too. What happened? These three bills on medical marijuana specifically implemented the Medical Marijuana Regulation Safety Act. So what was that? In October 2015, Governor Brown signed three measures, those three measures I just mentioned. These were a long overdue regulatory framework for enforcing and protecting the public against issues with regards to medical marijuana, which we didn't have before. So we were dispensing, buying, cultivating, distributing without a really big framework or an agency to enforce. So this also created certain programs, certain agencies with the authority to regulate medical marijuana in California. didn't change the legal status of marijuana, it just implemented this framework. Also designated funds for those agencies. Most of those will be effective in next January, 2018. Right now, what they're doing is they're writing the regulations so they can prepare for this new system. So along the back, so it's basically just a new structure to ensure that patients have access to medical marijuana and to ensure that there's a robust tracking system. It was also a clear signal to the federal government, the DEA and the Department of Justice, that basically California is moving along and implementing these robust controls, not just on paper, and just really going to implement it in practice. Then we come to 2016 and Proposition 64. We talked about recreational marijuana. So 2015 focused on medical marijuana and regulating it. 2016, here this proposition at the ballot box wants to legalize recreational marijuana. A big difference in policy change. So what did California voters do? We legalized in the California, in the state of California, we passed Prop 64 by 56% over a no vote of 44%. This basically allows adults 21 years and older to possess, use, and even grow marijuana for recreational purposes. It creates two new taxes and some medicinal exemptions from those taxes. The public can't purchase it yet, however. The actual official name of the act is Adult Use of Marijuana Act, AUMA. Its full name is the Control Regulated Tax Adult Use of Marijuana Act, so it kind of gives you an idea of what it's intended to do. Basic provisions, the three things it does, again, allows adults 21 years and older to possess 1 ounce of marijuana and cultivate up to 6 plants for personal use. Now, this is recreational. It regulates and taxes production, manufacture, and sale of marijuana for adult use, so here comes a revenue stream. And it rewrites the criminal penalties, and this is pretty important. It rewrites criminal penalties, reducing them to from felonies to misdemeanors. And it allows prior offenders to petition for reduced charges. So that is actually significant. I'm reading some passage from our state lieutenant governor. About giving you a little bit of sense of how the California hierarchies, the officers, officials, and public has viewed this change of Prop 64. So Lieutenant Governor, the local reactions with Gavin Newsom, I'm quoting him, "The war on drugs in California has been an abject failure. It has been a war on poor people of color, and it is time for change." In his opinion, California voters have stepped up and set an example for the nation. It's probably true that we have set an example for the nation because we set that example in 1996 by passing the Compassionate Use Act. And this probably, because it has reduced the criminal penalties, will change a lot of the views on marijuana in the state and probably in the country. Some of the news stations still believe that law enforcement is having problems with it because it's going to be a big thing to tackle, bigger thing to tackle now that it's legal. The Compassionate Use Act was a groundbreaker. They believe this is also a groundbreaker for the country. In addition, they believe that Prop 64 is a sea change in moving marijuana from small cooperative and little small clinical sales and dispensaries to this full-scale recreational use, making marijuana itself a very big business. So dollar signs and something of the nature of Marijuana Incorporated, I saw one that said Canna Business. So those are a lot of the things being talked about now. The license requirements for sales, though, will probably take another year or two. Some of the issues are still going to be debated at the local
respond to driving under the influence? What about marijuana in the workplace? And those are being debated right now, and there's some responses to that. There are also some predictions that land values in California are going to increase, and that this would be the response, like the gold rush was, you know, after gold was discovered, this would be the California gold green rush. So this is a little bit of the talk, the back talk of some of the stuff that you hear on the news. The act itself is huge, very long, a couple hundred pages, but the sections that are of interest are here: personal use section, the medical use, regulation and safety, the provision on the taxes, and the criminal offenses have been highlighted. So a little bit about, it's largely patterned on the 2015 Act, the regulatory provisions. They're consistent with that one. That was effective this year, although not totally implemented. Licenses for both medical and recreational use, they're distinct, but the Act actually has provisions for those to be consolidated under the auspices of one agency, so look for some changes in the future. It's extremely long and complex. There's a number of glitches and inconsistencies that the courts or the legislature will iron out under the Section 10, which allows some modifications. There's also some restrictions and oversights that a lot of users that currently use marijuana find objectionable, including medical marijuana users. So it makes it illegal to consume in any public place except for specifically licensed premises. So maybe a dispensary or a doctor's office or something like that. Continues to allow local governments to ban it, the medical marijuana cultivation and sales, so you don't have to have it in your location if your local government votes against it. It does ban vaporization in non-smoking areas, just like tobacco. And it imposes a really high tax, so 15% plus a tax increase on medical marijuana. Fortunately, that Section 10 I mentioned does allow for a lot of these things to be modified by the legislature, so those are going to have to be debated and then appealed, I suppose. Some of the marijuana advocacy organizations believe that the further changes are going to be needed, and they're needed to guarantee a number of things, and that it won't be the last word on marijuana reform. Affordable medical access, the taxes affect the medical users too. Protecting employment and protecting housing rights. Facilitating and allowing interstate commerce and banking. The personal use section, so no more than an ounce of marijuana, which is 28.5 grams, is highlighted there for possession. These are practical implications, cultivation up to 6 plants, no more than 6 per residence. And these don't apply to medical users. These are for recreational users who don't have this recommendation of a physician. In theory, a medical user could grow whatever they need to support what they need medically. And all plants that are harvested or marijuana in excess of an ounce have to be within the person's private residence, kept in a locked space, not visible from a public place. And the violations, you notice, are a fine, basically infractions and $250 fine for cultivation violations. Consumption, so you're not allowed to consume it in a public place except for a licensed dispensary. And that means if your local government does not allow that, then you cannot do that in a public place. Violation is a $100 infraction. Public place is defined as something broadly as any business or property that is open to the public. It's forbidden within 1,000 feet of a school or youth center, so that hasn't changed. Smoking and vaporizers are restricted, except in tobacco smoking areas, and the violation is a $250 infraction. So you're not going to be arrested unless you're some public problem. Use in vehicles, driving when you're impaired is unchanged. Consumption or possession of an open container is prohibited while driving, or riding as a passenger.
and a violation is $100 per infraction. And at, right now, at present, there's no law that prohibits medical patients from possessing it in an open container. It's a little bit of confusion, too. It does permit consumption in a passenger compartment for the where you're specially licensed. And it is lawful for adults to transport 1 ounce for personal use. And this overrides prior law. The school grounds where it's banned, it's no change from prior law. One interesting thing, too, is the employment rights. It does not interfere, the act does not interfere with employers' right to discriminate against marijuana users, whether it's medical or otherwise. And you could see that as a pharmacist, if I went to work and I was under the influence, employer would have a right to send me home or discharge me or sanction me. So it doesn't infringe on employer rights. Big area for law firms now. Paraphernalia, it makes their accessories legal for adult use and manufacture. So the medical use provision doesn't change anything in the Compassionate Use Act, allowing medical use. Physician recommendations have to comply with certain minimal standards that are already established. ID cards, same provision. It's voluntary. You get a state-issued what they call medical marijuana ID from the County Board of Health. Taxes are interesting because it's going to be allowing inspections to ensure that the sales and the taxes are collected. The taxes are collected from sales. So oversight. Back in 2015, they established the Bureau of Marijuana Control. Some funding was provided, and so the same regulation and safety will be under the Bureau of Marijuana Control. License categories also fit underneath this Bureau of Marijuana Control. The governor is going to be appointing an independent three-member appeals board to adjudicate appeals in this under this oversight of this bureau. Taxes. So this inspection that I mentioned, board and other law enforcement will be able to inspect any place where marijuana is sold, where it's cultivated, where it's stored, in order to ensure that the taxes are collected. So it's a big dollar ticket item. And the tax revenues allocated are going to go to this California Marijuana Tax Fund for a variety of different earmarks. So they include enforcement costs, public universities to study it and evaluate implementation of the act, California Highway Patrol to establish protocols to assess driver impairment, business and economic development for community reinvestment programs, the Center for Medical Cannabis Research to study efficacy and safety, youth education prevention, early intervention and treatment to prevent drug abuse, environmental cleanup and restoration. Those are just some of those. So the new penalty structure is what our Lieutenant Governor commented on. In all cases, offenders under 18 are not liable for criminal punishment any longer. So minor penalties, and they're only subject to drug education and community service. That's a huge shift from the past. So the marijuana saga, regardless of all the gripes, there's a lot of gripes about this law. It basically compares to most other laws in states that have also legalized marijuana for recreational use. And it does put pressure on politicians in Washington for federal marijuana reform. And noting that how many states have legalized it so far, continues to add to that number. But the other proposition is also true, that if it had not passed in California, there would have been a major setback for marijuana reform at the national level. So the fact that it passed, you could probably safely guess that it's going to move in a similar direction across the country, and Congress, Washington, maybe the Supreme Court eventually. The takeaway fact, 82 million, again, residents live in states that featured marijuana on the ballot in 2016 to loosen restrictions, not oppose restrictions. So is this a paradigm shift? Probably insofar as criminal reform, yes. But using pharmacy as an example, we now have in some three states, pharmacies as gatekeepers,
and our professional associations have issued policy statements. Pharmacy education begins evidence-based studies and teaching about evidence-based therapeutic uses. Our accrediting body is now requiring, I think, drug use in the curriculum. AACP, which is our Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, is requesting and suggesting medical marijuana training for student pharmacists. They issued curricular guidelines back as far as 2013. They have guidelines to train faculty on evaluating and assessing signs and symptoms of psychoactive drug abuse, not just marijuana, and also guidelines for policies within the schools. So what it promises is it's not over. There is going to be a lot of opportunities to provide leadership in health policy, even in the 21st century. The wave is moving forward. And I want to thank, I was invited by Dr. Paul Gavaza and Dr. Rashid Wasabin, and I want to thank them and the School of Pharmacy for bringing me here today.